What we'd be interested in doing in the history of the Saturn program is kind of connect back as much with some of the operations in the early history of rocketry, with some of the practices that have gone on in the Saturn program. And the more we work on this, we find that more we need some of the material on some of the earlier developments to relate to the Saturn program. I think we concentrated, when we first started working on the book, pretty much on a history of how things in the Saturn itself were made. And perhaps we want to go back a little bit and connect with earlier programs, not always going back to the V2, but at least getting some of the experience and reliability and quality control that was learned on the early missile programs on the Redstone and Jupiter and Pershing and these type of things. And I don't have any prepared questions as such, but we do want you to speak about quality and reliability. And you might start by saying what the state of the art was in Germany when did you start in this field? Have you always been in that?
Yeah.
I know you were more broad gauge back then.
Yeah, no, I was actually in the reliability and quality area only since 1958.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, I was in design, and in Peenemünde, I was on the test stand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, what we learned in Peenemünde has had some influence in the long run. It was there we actually learned the hard way. We had parts testing, not much of component testing as far as environment are concerned. And therefore, when those vehicles were supposed to fly, something failed due to vibration or influences which at that time were not under systematic investigation. There was therefore so many of the failures we found in the V2 program, they certainly can be traced back to failures of piece parts and components, not necessarily of any design, but they were just not built for such a type of environment. Now, from the arrival here in the United States, of course, we tried to eliminate some of those failure sources. So we took up contact, for instance, with relay manufacturers, and we could give them the vibration pattern which we had experienced on those V2s, and told them this is what we had experienced. Now, from that, show us a design which can meet those requirements. And for them, it was a new experience also. They had not thought about this, and in so many cases, this really triggered new designs, because they have to take a different approach in order to overcome the difficulties. Vibration is one, and then temperature is another one, high and low temperature. Those are essential factors.
Excuse me, did you do a failure analysis on the V2s that you brought over here to White Sands? Did you put telemetry on some of these parts that you thought were giving
you
trouble?
Oh yes, we had telemetry on, and we glued it in. And now,
did you put new telemetry on when you brought them over here?
There was telemetry in, but this was of a fairly small scale.
Yeah.
You see, and I can't recall what we had in the in White Sands in the V2, but in Germany, in that in those test flights of V2, we had a telemeter with six channels, six continuous channels, and then I think I had also 6 points. Now that isn't much, you know, 12 bits of information for such a vehicle. And with this we could not cover the difficulties we had in the piece parts and components. They usually hooked them up to real fundamental things which they had to learn for the overall design of the vehicle. Now here this wasn't changed, and we increased the number of channels in the telemeter considerably, and in the Saturn I think it was 1500 or so. So this is the advancement which had been made over the years in this respect, and with those many channels, of course, you have a much better opportunity to trace back the real cause of any problem. So at least from our arrival in the United States, we tried to make that information available to companies who were interested, Remember that we had contact with relay manufacturers. We had contact with a single core, particularly in the battery field, batteries, was such an item also. And from there on, we tried to build better things. And we started to systematically test those items when they come in. Mm-hmm. So we had, at that time, of course, fairly simple equipment, such a vibration machine, which went up from 5 to 60 cycles up and down, and what was it? I think 5 to 10 G in that level. So it was fairly simple. Mm-hmm. It was not really representative of the actual environment, but it showed a lot of deficiencies already, which we could then try to overcome again. And then, of course, the vibration equipment and all this environmental test equipment, they became more sophisticated also and had a better range. And so this step by step went up. So this was one of the things we introduced in the Redstone missile and in the Jupiter missiles. And this way we made progress. So I would say that the progress still wasn't sufficient. We had to do some more. And what we learned here then is, unless you tell the manufacturer exactly what that equipment he's to furnish has to do, in which way it has to perform, he's somewhat lost. And this was one of the things which I started here when I joined this laboratory in 1958. We said we have to systematically go back through the procurement documents and check that the procurement documents give the manufacturer all the information he needs, design-wise as well, environmental tests or requirements. And then we also have to tell him how we test those items, mm-hmm. so that he can run identical tests, and then we have some assurance that the test results will be the same. This was another difficulty. The test results in one place were this way and another place a different way. This is just due to the fact people had somewhat different equipment and this performed in different ways.
Did you ever get a situation where the manufacturer claimed that your specifications were simply unrealistic, they couldn't be met?
That our specifications are unrealistic?
Yeah.
No, this happens. But I wouldn't say this was of a serious nature. If we could show him what we had measured, each rocket carried telemetry, mm-hmm. and out of this we updated constantly. We had the group here in the, it's now the Marshall Space Flight Center, was at that time rocket ABMA later. Mm-hmm. They had a group of people, they were then in charge of predicting the environment. Mm-hmm. And this was for us the guideline. And in each flight, they had so much instrumentation in, which then actually had to measure. And the measurements, they evaluated and reflected into those guidelines. So they improved this constantly. Mm-hmm. So what we actually had to work with improved every year.
Mm-hmm.
So we could show the manufacturers, here those are test results. Of course, in different parts of the rocket, that's different.
Mm-hmm.
The instrument compartment was fairly mild, and in the area of the engine, that was pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that information and could make it available, and this way the manufacturer got a much better idea. And some reacted at that time and said, yeah, if we had known this before, and then we would have told you right away that this particular valve also wouldn't do the trick, because it isn't designed for it. And the design principles are different if we have to apply such environmental criteria. So from there on, that was approximately 1958, we started to systematically check into all the procurement requests which went out, and made sure that they contain not only the drawings, but the also good specifications which really cover it, and adding to it the latest status of environmental conditions the item would have to meet. And from there on, we also said what we expect, or how we would expect the test to be run. Not telling the manufacturer that's the only only way of doing it. He might have better ways, but at least giving him some idea to what the depths we would like to have it done. And with this, I would say the situation started to improve, and we got better parts in and better components than before. So this encouraged us then to continue that route. So now, was one more feature we had to cover. While we were still with the Army, we had the support of a so-called Industrial Operations Division, and they let the contracts to industry, the major contracts. And in their contracts there was a, we called it the boilerplate statement, which said the quality and reliability assurance methods have to comply with the requirements of the government, or such a general statement, or have to be acceptable to the government, not comply with, had to be acceptable to the government. And this we couldn't believe is sufficient. But at that time we couldn't convince the other party that we have to tell the manufacturer or the prime contractor what we expect, what we would expect to be acceptable. So we in the early, when was it, 1960, we became part of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And at that time, we cut the link to that Industrial Operations Division and had to replace it with something of our own. And what we did at that time, we studied the available applicable documents of the Army, Air Force, and Navy. And out of those documents, we extracted what we thought are real good requirements. And then we added to it what we had learned over the years due to our involvement with the hardware. And made this a very particular point, that the paper is one thing, but hardware is another one. And hardware has to be attended to, so it has to be not only inspected when it comes in, it has to have a functional test, it has to have a qualification test, and it has to be good before we even start to install it in a vehicle. So we put this all together, and this became the NPC 200-1-2-3, those three NASA documents, which
you
might have heard about.
Were they put together here in NOT headquarters? Did headquarters concur in those, or did you put them together here?
We put them together here. At least we furnished the first draft, yeah? We furnished the first draft, and then when we had this, we recognized this is not a problem only for the Marshall Space Flight Center, that is a problem which NASA has to address itself. But at that time, I established a contact with the Reliability and Quality Assurance Office in headquarters and showed them what we have done and encouraged them to publish this as a NASA document. And so with them, they were very receptive to the idea. They looked it over and they had some comments to make, which were very valuable, and we incorporated them. So we developed out of this let's call it a final draft. Yeah? And this we wanted to have signed off by the administrator. And the administrator of NASA, he thought, oh, that looks good, but how can I be sure that what you want to sell me here is real good? So he hired a group of consultants, about 10 or so, from various industries and from government agencies, all people who had established their reputation in the reliability or quality field. And he put them to work and let them look over our documents and ask them now, you tell me whether they are real good documents. And those consultants went to work and came out with some recommendations. By and large, they accepted them. They thought they were good. But they had so many recommendations. And after they have made them, we sat together. And so many we didn't believe in, so we took them off again. And others we incorporated. And I think it was a real worthwhile effort that they made those. I'm sure they saved us a lot of worry later on. So after this had been done, the administrator signed off, and these became the three documents which I mentioned, NBC 200-1, 2, and 3. With them we tried to work with industry. And industry, let's say the reception industry, was a mixture. By and large, they had some resistance to it. And you can understand this, because everybody likes to do it his own way, but there are so many in industry who really supported the idea after they had studied it. And I like to mention here the McDonnell Douglas. No, it was at that time Douglas, Douglas, not McDonnell. And they took one of their senior designers and told him he should now take care of quality and reliability. And the first job they gave him, they handed him those NASA documents. And they told him, now we give you 2 or 3 weeks time and you study them thoroughly. And when you are through with it, then we hope you come back and tell us how we can bypass, tear up, or otherwise dispose of those documents. And this man, he went to work, and after he had finished his study, he went back to this company management and told them, I find nothing wrong with those documents. What they ask for is actually what we should do on our own. So after I learned this, I expected they would take that man off his job and put him back into the design where he came from. To my surprise, they did not. Yeah. They left him on the job. And on their own, it worked quite well. So gradually the documents were accepted by industry. I would say by and large, we experienced less resistance than I had originally anticipated. So it went better than anticipated.
You wouldn't be willing to give us this man's name, would you?
Oh, yeah, I guess W.W. Reaser, R.E.A.S.E.R.
Okay.
He's not with Douglas anymore. He was retired meanwhile, and to my knowledge, he went to work for another company. But he had that job with Douglas until, I would say about 69 or so. We have worked with him all the time and worked out all right. Not saying that we had no difficulties, whatever. That's not the case. But they're not bigger than we could handle them. Now we had one main difficulty in this entire exercise. These NASA documents came too late for some of the contracts. At that time, the pressure was on, let the contract and worry about the details later, by time. Yeah? After Kennedy had given that green light, that was the ground rule. So the companies, they got not too well-defined contract, and of course, we at that time were not ready either. So those documents we tried to introduce in some cases only after the contract had been let. And this resulted in some cost increases. The companies took the opportunity to say, now we have no program of such a nature, or we didn't think that far, and therefore in order to do all this we need to charge somewhat more. So some companies try to take advantage of that, and to some degree, of course, they were entitled to some more reimbursement because we asked for somewhat more. So, but anyhow, as time went by, we incorporated those documents into all the major contracts and have been going that route since.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what else did we mention?
But you still did, prior to these NASA documents, still did have quality and reliability functions attached to the contractors from your old ABMA experience. You did make them perform certain tests on the equipment before government accepted it.
Yeah. Now, these NASA documents are more in general terms. We call them actually guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And they spell out what do we expect in a decent quality assurance or reliability assurance program be incorporated. There are so many essential features which we think are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
We did not try to tell the contractor how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We left this up to him. So he was supposed to come back with a plan how he wants to do that, and we would compare our requirements of the general nature with his plan.
Mm-hmm.
Now if we think he meets the requirements and or the intent of our guidelines, then it's fine. If we think he does not, then we would go back to him and tell him where we think the deficiencies are and ask him to improve these specific areas. So this is the approach we have been taking since that time and we are still taking. Now those documents have been revised meanwhile. They came out in 1970 again under a different number, and some of the experience has been worked in some areas have been made somewhat more specific, but the skeleton is the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an improved version, not a complete revision.
What about some of the vendors down in the second layer? For example, McDonnell Douglas took your NASA specifications or guidelines.
Yeah.
Did they use those guidelines in their own documents to their vendors and subcontractors?
No, this has been a sore spot. This is what we expected, that they use those and in turn apply them to their subcontractors. But this was not done to the desired extent. So they passed on some of them, but they were quite willing to give the subcontractors an easier life. Now this didn't take too long, and we found that the hardware doesn't come out the way it's supposed to, and then we stepped in and made our surveys together with Douglas, North
mm-hmm.
American, and all IBM, all those contracts involved, went to their vendors and found out there what the weaknesses are, and then they had to step this up and improve. And this is one of the features we put in more pronounced in the new editions, that the prime contractor is obligated to put on his vendors basically the same requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you have always to make them, you have to make them tailor-made somewhat to the specific case, but by and large, this is the way to go, and put basically the same requirements on the subcontractor and vendor. So this has been an area which caused us a lot of concern over the years, and I hope that with the next project we are over the hump in this respect,
mm-hmm.
and by putting emphasis on it from day number one, we should be in a better shape than we were in the Saturn project. That cost us lots of extra work.
Mm-hmm.
And some vendors couldn't supply at all. So we had to find other sources to supply this. And then, of course, this problem comes in to meet the schedule. And if you push that so much, then someone has to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little bit a chain reaction. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But this has been recognized, meanwhile, not only by us, but by all the prime contractors involved. They are fully aware of the importance which has to be placed on the proper attention to the subcontractors and vendors.
Mm-hmm.
So they have learned from that also. There were a few companies who had recognized it real early. One of them was Martin Marietta.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tight They had done a real fine job from early beginning to keep this under control, and the results of this has now spilled over to other industries.
Would you say other contractors like McDonald and Boeing and North American learned from the Martin Marietta experience on Titan?
I think so, yeah. So from that experience and our pressure then to apply the same. We went out with those companies, as I mentioned. So we had a team together with Boeing people going to all their vendors and with all the prime contractors, we had to do this. And this opened their eyes as well as ours. We learned also so many things which we were not aware before. So I would say that nowadays we are much better prepared for any major project than we were in the early 60s when we got that, that Saturn project. So we also have evaluated meanwhile all the failures which occurred during the Saturn development, and have compiled this and make it available to any new contractor or any contractor who gets a new contract, and this way try to prevent some of the deficiencies we had found in the Saturn area. We also have developed some better methods in non-destructive testing area, and we put them into that booklet also and make them available to all industries so that they can really take advantage of the progress which has been made. But there's a lot of more progress which needs to be made. There's such a new vehicle like the shuttle that has new requirements, new technologies, longer lifetime, so we might again run in areas which need to be explored and developed somewhat for better methods.
Is it possible to qualify certain areas of the quality and reliability program as being more difficult than others? For example, did electronics cause more difficulties than, say, cryogenic systems, or propulsion systems create more difficulty than vehicle engineering problems?
Yeah, it is somewhat depending to whom you talk. If you talk to a mechanical engineer, he would tell you all the electronics cause a problem, and the other way around. So we have no real statistics to prove it. We have tried to get a handle on this, but the results were not so convincing. Now, it is certainly true that the electronic area has got a tremendous amount of attention, and the progress which has been made there, the advance of the technology, is tremendous. Now, the mechanical area has made progress also, but they really have not come up with any revolutionary things. You know, they still deal with the leakages, and believe it or not, the soap and bubble method is still in use. And so many people, they are convinced that's the best one. It still shows me where it leaks. And all the other more sophisticated methods, they are good also, and they help to speed up. You know, with such a sniffler, you can go along and then, oh, here must be something, and there we can then concentrate, but then we take the soap and bubble and really pinpoint it. So I wouldn't dare to say that one area is better than the other, but the general progress in the electronic area is tremendous. And we now have put a large, an important emphasis, I think that's one of the cornerstones for the future. We put a very big emphasis on the selection of the piece parts. So we do not buy them off the shelf, or in most cases we have developed specifications, so-called high reliability specifications. We have developed those, and together with industry, very good cooperation, they develop their manufacturing lines according to this. And then if this is an operation, we send a team in which looks that over, and if that line is in good shape, this assembly line or manufacturing line, then we even give them a so-called line certification, which is good for up to 2 years. And if they continue, of course, we put out good products, this can be extended. If they fail, then this is revoked. And we got a real good cooperation from industry, because it helps them also. And NASA has only one customer now who asks for real good parts. Others are starting more and more also, because their failure history in components shows that this is necessary to pay attention to that. And those items which are not developed as high reliability items, we screen them. That means when they come in so many lots, and we submit them to tests. For instance, cycling tests or screening tests, burn-in tests. And from there we weed out the weak ones, and those who survive certain criteria, they are considered the best ones. Mm-hmm. And if we do this, then our failure rate goes down considerably. Now it's still a problem to sell this, because this costs money. Mm-hmm. And we believe, and we can in so many cases prove it, that this investment pays off, because they're troubleshooting later on, and the Tiger teams and all these emergency measures that have to be taken, they cost a tremendous amount of time and money. And we had a case just recently where a company